This is John Fanistel, one of the pastors at First United Methodist Church of San Diego, and I've been leading a project for the last couple of years called the Apostello Academy, trying to find new ways of inviting innovative Christian leadership. And I'm here with two folks who have participated in the first round of a leadership intensive. This was an 18-month program in which we invited people who felt called to serve their God and their neighbor to try something new and see what came of it. And so I'm sitting with Seth Clark and Julie Walker, two participants in the leadership intensive of the Apostello Academy. And thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having us, John.
Yeah, no problem.
So what I wanted to do in this brief conversation is ask you to reflect on your experience. And I thought we'd start with your experience with a project that you piloted or the project that you initiated. Perhaps each of you could tell me a little bit about what the project was you ran and any top shelf takeaways that you gained from it.
Who wants to go first?
I will let you go first, Julie.
Okay, sounds good. All right, well, the project that I ran ended up calling it Story Share. And the whole concept behind it was to create an outside of the walls of the church outreach initiative to engage college students, young adults, upcoming generations, you know, people around San Diego, but especially focusing on sort of that young adult age, college age. For the past 2 years, I've been serving as the Wesley Foundation Director at San Diego State University. So this was a joint project between the Wesley Foundation and then the church plant that I was part of as well. So let me kind of give you a little bit of a story. Let me start off with a story about StoryShare because that seems appropriate. One day I was on campus, and at that time I had an office that was kind of tucked away in this apartment complex. No one knew it existed. No one knew the Wesley Foundation ministry existed. So I walked outside to kind of refresh my mind, and I looked down toward the entryway, the main entryway of campus, and I saw this giant pink polka-dotted bus. It was huge, and there were people lining up outside of this bus. And I thought, what in the world is going on? So I went down there to check it out, and I realized that it was a Victoria's Secret bus. And they were selling their summer lineup of swimwear and tank tops and even some underwear, I think. They were selling it to people on campus out of this bus. And I thought to myself, you know, if Victoria's Secret can be so mobile and creative with what they're doing, can't the church, can't we be a little bit more creative than being tucked away in this little office space? So I started dreaming and scheming of what a mobile, more dynamic and creative ministry could look like. I had a couple conversations with my church plant pastor and some other folks, and to make the story a little bit shorter, we ended up purchasing a 1964 Ford Falcon Club Wagon. So think your iconic California sort of surf van. And we found it on Craigslist. When we bought it, we thought it was pretty sound. Like, we test drove it, it worked out fine. And then we had a couple artists we recruited who turned it into a mobile art project. They painted a mural that wrapped around it. And our whole idea was, we're going to take this van to different venues and we're going to interact with people by asking them to share stories about themselves, about what inspires them, about life. And we would be sort of this mobile collection of people's stories, and we would travel and share and collect stories, and through that hope to also connect people to the church, hoping that people would be intrigued to ask us, who are you, why are you doing this, and what is your story? And then we could start sharing about how we see a bigger story in the world. So that is what my project consisted of. It met a lot of challenges, a lot of speed bumps, figuratively, literally, and a lot of mechanical issues, which, should I dive into that portion of?
Yeah, so I know that bit of the story, that the van really, the repairs of the van were prohibitively expensive and limited your range of activity. Is that a fair summation?
Right. So the way that we were able to fund the project initially is we received two $5,000 grants, so a total of $10,000 to test this project out. We ended up buying our van for $5,500, and we were trying to stay, you know, definitely under budget because we knew we would have to make some repairs, and we wanted to have funding for art and other stuff we would need for, like, buying supplies for the different events, you know, reserving spaces at venues, all of that stuff. So it was tricky to find the right vehicle, and when we bought it, we thought it was fine. We had it looked over. We had it for about a month, and then everything on the van started breaking. I think I had that van towed probably about 8 times, maybe more. I had it towed from parking lots. I had it towed from the middle of the street. I got to the point where it had broken down on me so many times trying to get it to venues that I had a bit of an anxiety attack while driving it once because it stalled going up this super steep hill. And just to give you some idea of what was going on, I mean, the battery died a couple times, but that's an easy fix. The big things, once the steering gearbox broke, luckily we were in a parking lot, we weren't barreling down the interstate, but you need to be able to steer your van, right? So that was a big deal, and
that's
luckily,
a little scary.
Yeah, luckily we found a replacement part at a local shop that had some connections. It's also finding parts for a particular van was difficult. The thing that really killed it is when the gas tank started leaking. The gas gauge didn't work, by the way. It ran out of gas on the highway once. That's how I found that out. That was one of the tow truck incidents. But then I decided, you know, I'm going to keep this tank full. So that won't happen again until we get this gauge fixed. So I filled it up, and then gas started spewing out of the tank.
Right.
And think about safety concerns with that. I mean, I could have blown it up. I could have blown up the project.
And yourself.
And myself. That could have been how I went out, flames of glory in that old van. Took it to a shop, thought we had fixed the problem, got a hose and a gasket replaced. Then the next time we filled it up again, it started spewing gas.
Yeah.
And we got it patched, but that was a temporary fix, and we knew we were going to have to find a total new tank and just couldn't find a replacement part. Like, the shop we had used before couldn't find it.
So the outings that you did take the van to, were you energized by those experiences?
You know, the best outing that we actually got the van to, which it did break down a little bit on the way, we got out and we pushed it for probably half of a football field before it would start again. But we took it to the homecoming tailgate party at Qualcomm Stadium for San Diego State. And once we actually got there, it was great. People were flocking to the van because they thought it was cool, they wanted to check out the art, they wanted to take pictures in front of it. So we got to talk to a ton of people. There was a lot of energy. And so that was a picture of what it could have been like.
Yeah.
And I will admit, it was difficult to sort of transition from we're story share, we collect stories, to anything about faith and God in the church. So that's definitely an area where we would have needed some more tweaking on how to frame our conversation, how to describe who we are and what we're about. But we didn't really get the chance to fully test out the project just because the van broke down.
So in some sense it was an incomplete pilot project because you didn't get to run it through to a point where you could really make an honest assessment of its viability.
Yeah, I would say it's definitely incomplete. I mean, I think the concept itself still had potential. We just couldn't get the van to the venues that we wanted.
I've been really playing around recently with, I don't know if you've seen them, but these graphs that show Amazon's growth in retail sales compared to all of the traditional retailers. You know, these charts, which are in every imaginable configuration, are just, it's stunning, right? The rate of growth of Amazon in retail sales compared to, which is basically mobile delivery of retail items,
mm-hmm.
as compared to fixed delivery of retail items. It's not a competitive game. The mobile delivery of retail items is simply crushing the competition.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the apartment complex I walk into every day where I live, Amazon packages by every door.
Correct. So I do hope someday, somewhere, somehow, that that model of a mobile young adult ministry seems to me... Do you feel like, in principle, the concept of a mobile ministry of outreach to young adults, in principle, does that concept still have some traction with you?
The concept does. I think you would have to find the right setting to run a project like that, which San Diego is very ideal. For one, the weather's great, so there are a lot of events that happen outside. People tend to be outside. In a place where it rained constantly or half the time it was winter, I don't think it would work as well. Also, I think it would have to be sort of just a cultural setting where people appreciate artistic things and media-based things. So we had a Facebook page that went along with it. Sort of the plan, if we had continued running the project, would have been to increase the media components as far as what we're able to share online.
And then the connection to the faith story is it would be another puzzle that would remain to be solved.
Yeah, remain to be solved. I think it can be done, and I'm disappointed that we didn't get to really run the project fully and have conversations around how could we adjust this to make this it's an easier inroad for talking about, faith and connecting people to community and to a source of hope if that's what they're looking for.
Well, thank you very much for sharing that. Seth, what was your experience with Encompass Cowork?
So, I did a pilot project of a co-working space. And for those who are listening who are unfamiliar, that's okay. It's a pretty new concept. Started about 11 years ago now. Co-working is a shared workspace. Well, and that's not new. But instead of you renting your own office or merely your own desk, and all you do is go in and do your work, a co-working space is also a community in which you and other folks in that same space, in a sense, do life together, do professional and personal development together. It's the ideal of it is that the best and brightest ideas are things you can bounce off of one another, both in kind of an informal way at the coffee stand that's in there, or in a more formal way if you, as independent contractors, because most people working there are contractors, you have some sort of formal business partnership. So co-working is taking the world by storm in this gig economy. I was in London and Paris just last week, and even over there I saw co-working spaces. And I know from having done research before and during this project that co-working is all over. So you think of any big city in the world and there's probably a co-working space, from Dubai to Hong Kong to Nairobi. All of them have these co-working spaces because we live in a gig economy, right? So the 40-hour work week where you from 9 to 5, 9 to 6 are sitting in your traditional office or your traditional cubicle even, that's kind of moving out the door. And instead, you're hired as a contractor or as a temp or whatever else. But people still need community. And that's, for us, was a big value. People still needed community. People, we believed as Christians, people were made in the image of God. And part of that image is relational. And so that relationality, even though we may not use that theological concept when we're talking to people and trying to find new co-workers, people know that they're relational by nature. And the type of people who would be interested in co-working spaces are people who don't want to just sit at home. They want to get out because they're more productive, or they want to have some sort of social life even as they have a work life, or whatever else. So this is a big concept. It's all over in really interesting ways across San Diego and the world. And we wanted to see if we could have a church-based co-working space.
And what did you find out?
So we found out that, here's the big one. We did not have enough money to make it work. So we had a space. Thankfully, First Church gave us a classroom that we converted into kind of an office space with a meeting room and had some storage, and there's a kitchenette and all of this, right? So it seemed like a good space, but we didn't have any money for marketing. We didn't have any money to hire anybody. I volunteered hours and hours, countless hours to this. But yeah, we didn't have any sort of paid staff. We didn't have any real money to do any of the things that you need to do when you're basically starting a business. And so it was hard to get the word out. We had a website, we had a social media presence. We did that according to the book and did a good job of it, I would say. But at the same time, we didn't have what it took to really compete with these high-end co-working spaces that are in town and more coming into town. So while we were going, WeWork, which is one of the largest co-working, it's international, all that, they came into town, and every time I did any searches, they were the first thing that came up in Google or Bing or any of those, because they were paying buku bucks in order to get the word out that they were around. So it's hard to compete with that. I think in 5, 10, 15 years, as co-working becomes more than just a niche thing and more than just a high level kind of thing, a luxury almost, that's perhaps the time when a church-based co-working space could be of use, where people come and they don't have to pay quite as much, but they're also not expecting, you know, craft kombucha or even craft beer. But instead, they're just expecting a nice place to work with some good company. So later on, I think this may be a good thing. But right now, it's really hard to compete with the big guys who have a lot of money for marketing. And, you know, they get a lot of money. It's at least $300, probably more like $400, to have full-time access to any co-working space in San Diego.
So you mentioned the notion of relationality. In principle, the co-working ethos rings true with you, or is harmonious with your understanding of the church, and ecclesiologically, you feel like co-work has a kind of some resonance?
Yeah, so if I look at it through kind of a theological eye, I see that humans are created for fellowship, for relationship, and even in work, I think there's plenty of statistics that show that people work better if they have some sort of community with whom they can bounce ideas off of or just share their life with. And so, yeah, that relationality, that's a huge part of the church. Every church that I've been to, whether it's the most conservative or the most progressive, whatever it looks like, people there are wanting to connect not only with God but with others. They're wanting to have life-on-life realities. And so a co-working space can be very similar, even though the content of what's going on isn't, you know, churchy, but they're still wanting to connect that life-on-life aspect. They're wanting to, generally, most people doing this, they're wanting to make the world a better place. They're wanting their work to have an impact that goes beyond them as an individual.
From the moment that the idea emerged, I liked it because churches across the nation are struggling with what really is this tremendously inefficient allocation of resources. All these buildings sitting around that typically get used in any significant measure only a few hours a week. Mm-hmm. And more and more churches, of course, churches have always run midweek programming, and more churches are making their facilities available on a tenant basis to try to maximize use of facilities, you know, facing income shortages and whatnot. But the idea of something through the week, through the work week, that's integrated with the church life seems to me to make utter sense. But I appreciate the, what do they call it, the barriers to entry of the marketplace, right?
Yeah, and the barriers, I think, are high, but are thankfully lessening. So I still have a hope that someday, maybe not in my future, but in the future of the church, this could be a way not only to bring in revenue, which is of course vitally important, but also to integrate into society in a way that is more holistic. You mentioned, you know, church kind of only operates a few hours a week, And I don't think that's anybody's ideal of what the church should look like. The church should somehow inform the life of the faithful, and even if the theology isn't informing, but somehow the life of the church, I think the heart of the church should inform others as well, regardless of where they're at. And there's that human spirit that can thrive. And so I think, I'm still hopeful, even though this project is kind of in the rearview mirror for me. I'm hopeful that someday, somehow, a co-working space that's part of a church or part of a faith organization or something like that could go forward and be a great success.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you both, shifting gears a little bit, to think about your experience with the Apostello Academy in larger frame. This was a pilot project in itself that mixed some classroom learning, project-based incubator, some site visits and other things. And it was a cohort that dwindled across time. We started with 18 and ended up with about 8 or 10 active participants. And I know you all have extensive experience, both having graduate degrees and whatnot, so the classroom setting was nothing new to you. But I'm just interested, maybe the easiest way to think of it is, or the easiest way for me to ask is, what will be your fondest memory of this experience in the Apostello Academy? Was there a favorite part of it, a favorite dimension of the experience that you will look back on with fondness?
Do you want to start, or do you want me to start?
You can start if you're ready. Oh,
okay, I'll start. I think for me, one thing that we'll always look back on with fondness is that the Apostle Academy was, for me and those around me, a hub of creativity. Right within the church, I've worked inside of different churches and congregations for over a decade now. But within the church, there's not always an impetus or a desire or an openness to thinking in creative ways about new projects, about innovation. But this is an area in which we need to think about things in order to kind of survive into the future. I think just seeing everybody and their different projects, even now sitting and listening to Julie and her project, and even though it wasn't quote unquote successful, all that she learned through it and just that spirit of innovation that was a part of it is a real blessing to me and others as well, with different kinds of youth group, home groups, or different prayer groups that are happening within First Church, or even the ideas that for one reason or other couldn't get off the ground, like one called Common Lingua, where there was a shared meal over diverse languages and trying to learn those languages and being multicultural and cross-cultural. All of these are great ways of showing the beautiful nature of who we are as Christians and the beautiful nature of God and how God really loves people. And we see in Scripture all the time that our God is a God of newness. And so rooting it back into theology, we just see that even though God is, in some ways, you could, if you're going to get old school and theological, in some ways unchanging, you could also say that God is the God of newness and fresh things. And so the Apostolic Academy was very much a place for fresh takes and fresh ideas.
So for you, it really was the I'm interested, I'm hearing resonance in this, the sense that the concept, some of the concepts that we generated and or were generated remain attractive, and then the implementation and the tactical or the practical nature of things, the costs and the mechanics and the implementation and the 'cause it sounds to me like you the idea of creating a space for creativity and innovation remains compelling to you.
Very much so. So I've always been kind of outside the box in terms of my ideas of how to do ministry, how to reach people. Admittedly, I'm much less progressive when it comes to other areas of church, but when it comes to ministry innovation, I've always had this knack and this desire to see things continue to move forward. And so for me, that was great to just see it happen in real life, because that was the first time I had ever actually seen a church-based program think in a holistic and thorough manner about how to do things afresh, how to do things anew.
Thank you. How about you, Julie? Top shelf fond memory? Is there one forming in your mind?
Oh, there's some themes, at least. Just listening to Seth, I also really appreciate just that space that was created for innovation and for new things. And I've done young adult and college ministry for quite some time, and that's kind of, it's not your typical church stuff. What you end up doing in college ministry sometimes, but especially coming out to San Diego, being the only staff person for the Wesley Foundation here, to have a space where I was around other people who were, you know, thinking about, well, what can we do? What can we do that's new? And just seeing passion in other people gave me a sense of having some colleagues when I felt like I didn't have any for a while after arriving here, and sort of being the director and trying to figure out, well, what do I do? So that was good. For me too, I would say it offered me some consistency, like knowing that I would be with these people on a weekly basis, that we're all kind of trying to figure out, what are we going to do for our projects? How are we really going to make them work? Listening to other people say, oh, I tried this and it didn't work, and having to reassess. So being on kind of the same pathway was encouraging, because sometimes I think ministry, at least for me, can be a challenging and a lonely journey at moments, especially when you're not working within a team around you.
Well, how about if I were to at some point do the leadership intensive again, irrespective of length of time or schedule or the kind of practical matters, if there were one suggestion, a key change or key correction that you would make to the process and the model, what might be if I 3 years from now were to want to convene another group for another leadership intensive that included the incubator component, what would do you think I should make sure to bake into the new version of the Apostello Academy? Is there a key course correction that you would recommend for me?
I think something that I would appreciate seeing is, I know we had several guest lecturers, and if we could have some guest lecturers who have themselves created some type of innovative or new ministry, that could come and tell us about their experiences and maybe pitfalls that we could watch out for, and just hearing, you know, some personal journeys of people who have done this before, and successes and failures along the way would be good.
Because we did have lectures, but they were mostly on the academic topics, weren't they?
Yeah.
So we didn't really resource it. We didn't resource the incubator piece with expert testimony and expert case studies.
Yeah, I think that would be neat to hear from people who would describe themselves as innovators or entrepreneurs. Maybe in addition to or replacing some of the more academic topics.
Thanks for that. Thank you. Seth, how about you? Any top shelf course corrections come to mind?
I think I would extend the pitch practice that's a part of it. So the way it is right now, there's a pitch practice kind of at the end, or there's a pitch at the end that you practice along the way. But for some programs, even the pilot project is going to take some sort of money. So I think of Julie's. Her pilot project took a lot of money, but she was able to receive some grant money, and I think about some others that receive some grant money. But if somehow there was a process from the beginning to be able to fund things a little more, I think there could be more potential for success. And the people who, you know, perhaps need a little bit more funding, who don't have the hours and hours that I did to volunteer, perhaps that would relieve them of some of that stress or fear of doing something big. Because, you know, there's a dollar figure attached.
That makes a lot of sense to me. I had one conversation with a guy who came to one of the pitch practice sessions, and his comment afterward was he questioned, he was not part of the church nor really all that familiar with the church, and his question was, well, what's the ecosystem within which these projects are being incubated? And part of the ecosystem he was referring to, because I asked him, was the financial or resource ecosystem, right? And I realize, looking back now, that I didn't think that through nearly thoroughly enough. And I would only, my own sense is, I would only want to do this again if I, in fact, had, I don't want to, you know, not millions of dollars, but certainly some pool of funding that would be available to resource projects as they were being incubated. Mm-hmm. And that there would be some pool of funds that would pre-exist the incubator experience, both as an incentive to participants because they know there might be some funding available to them, but also because I do think a lot of the projects, even the ones that showed initial promise, we weren't able to see them through because we didn't have the dollars necessary to do course corrections and adaptations and, you know, take a second swipe at something. To buy a new van, right? This kind of thing. So, mm-hmm. Well, good. Well, let me then maybe as we shift toward wrapping this up. Both of you, I know, having gotten to know you over these last months, have a very strong sense of calling. But I know that each of you are in a perhaps somewhat different place than you were 18 months ago in that respect. I'm wondering, you know, how would you describe, do you feel like your sense of vocation, that your calling has changed over the last 18 months? And if so, how? Or is it the same calling, but you just are headed in a slightly different direction than you might have thought yourself to have been headed had I asked you 18 months ago what you were up to? Has your sense of calling changed over the last 18 months?
I think my sense of calling has sort of continued to evolve. I know that I will probably always be called to ministry in some capacity. And ministry, that is the more outside the box, outside the walls type. I've always been drawn to sort of trying to figure out how to interact with people who are definitely not going to walk into a church building, are not going to come to something that's labeled a ministry program, and sort of appreciating that challenge of how do I be authentic, and how do I also share Jesus with the world? So I think, you know, Jesus is the salvation of the world and the hope that we need. But how can I bring that hope to people in a way that they can really receive it and to meet them where they are? And so I definitely know that will always be part of my life, but as far as ministry as a career, I think it definitely has taken a turn based on where I was maybe 18 months ago. I've been serving the United Methodist Church for about seven years now, as a staff person doing college ministry. And there have been different periods where, you know, I've considered ordination. There have been different time periods where I thought I would probably become a pastor. But there is just something about, I couldn't commit my entire heart and soul to the process that would have gotten me ordained.
And do you think it was the process
I think the process was part of it, to be honest. It is quite the process. And since I had several friends who ended up being Methodist pastors, Methodist elders, and they began as soon as they graduated college, and I didn't. And I think the longer I waited, the longer the process appeared in my mind. And also just knowing that I maybe approach things a little bit differently than your traditional church stuff, I could never picture myself being the pastor of a traditional, very liturgical looking congregation. I knew that just didn't fit who I was.
And so the campus ministry for you seemed one expression of that. It wasn't pastoring a congregation. But even that campus ministry experience didn't have, or did it? Did it feel like to you a, I don't know, career path, or did it seem like, because you did a couple of different campus ministries, I know. Mm-hmm. Did it feel like a career path that you were on, or did it feel like just these were exploratory sojourns in your desire to serve Jesus?
I think I saw it as a career path, but it became a more and more difficult career path because since I'm not ordained, a lot of the director positions do require ordination in order for you to apply and be able to serve in that role. And the places where ordination isn't required are usually the places that have more funding problems, so they can't afford an elder. There have been funding issues with campus ministry out here in the San Diego area. So just even there, I felt like I wasn't a perfect fit because I couldn't land a job that would necessarily be stable to hit some life goals that I have. Just having to reassess, I know I want to serve God, but within the Methodist Church, I don't know that I really see a fit.
I remain fascinated, and this was part of the Apostello Academy idea, and I myself, having worked both as a local church pastor and outside the church for the better part of a decade, I really remain convinced that we don't have our pipeline and institution is kind of set up to presume one outcome, which is the ordained elder. And we don't have effective pipeline or supports and or career paths for folks who feel called to serve God and neighbor, but who don't feel called to pastoring local churches. It's kind of like there's this one box.
Right.
Or one square, or what is it? Square peg, round hole. So I guess it's a round hole. And those of us who are square pegs, we can squeeze ourselves into the round hole if it's the right size, but it still feels not the right fit. I think, and we don't have in the United Methodist Church a way of honoring and rewarding callings that don't fit our round hole. That's my experience. Would that ring true with your experience over the last number of years?
I mean, some of that is definitely resonating with me. I have felt like the piece that didn't fit into mm-hmm. the path. Mm-hmm. Something that I definitely was attracted to and felt drawn toward was church planting, starting up new faith communities. And even with that, when I would start to look into programs or talk with people, not being ordained was a concern. And I thought about, maybe the licensed local pastor route could be potential. That would be easier for me to accomplish right now. But was kind of discouraged away from that direction by several people.
Yeah, we have these other places. We have deacons, ordained deacons, and licensed local pastors and so forth. But they aren't invested with... I don't think they're in my experience or observation is they're not invested with much respect, institutionally speaking, which translates into not much support, financially speaking, right. And which makes therefore those other paths to service less attractive. Thinking in very, if we want to think in human terms, but less viable in terms of, you know, in terms of producing fruit, right? If you're not irrigating and, you know, tilling the soil in those patches of the garden, and, you know, you're not going to see growth. I think that I have felt for a long time that we don't do a good job of, you know, we pour all our energy and resources into one patch of our garden. That would be my sense of it.
And yeah. Well, I'll give you a little bit of insight into sort of the direction I'm thinking now.
Please.
As far as vocation. For a while, I've been interested in leadership development, nonprofit, and business management, sort of human systems operations. And so, I don't know, I hit age 30, and I thought, well, now might be a good time to look at a potential career change, maybe do something different, look at some different directions. So right now I'm researching some MBA programs, some leadership development type direction stuff, and well, still a little bit more research to go, but definitely could see myself working in an arena like that, with some type of organization that does good in the world, either for profit or nonprofit, both I'd be open to. Because I know that, you know, I have the potential to be a good leader, and if it's not, you know, the right fit within the church, I'll still serve God and I'll still offer leadership somewhere.
Thank you for that. Thank you. Seth, what's your reflection over the last 18 months as your vocation?
So I actually, when I was told about the Apostello Academy, I was told that it was more or less a place for people who were interested in possibly seeking ordination. And as soon as I talked to you, John, I realized it wasn't exactly that. But along the way, that was something that was in my mind and in my heart. What would it look like to perhaps pursue ordination within the United Methodist Church? And to be quite honest, along the way, not because of the academy, but just being involved in different levels with the church, I realized that it's not for me. There's several reasons. One is itinerancy. I just could never, and my wife could never agree to uprooting. Like, we've uprooted a couple times because of academics and whatnot, but to always have that over our heads, especially when we consider our first ministry to be our family. My wife's pregnant, which is pretty cool. But so that son that's supposed to be born here in a few months, that person is my ministry. And to uproot him because of the system I would be in just doesn't seem like my ideals. So that's one reason. Other reasons are, like Julie said, the process just seems too long. I too am in my 30s. I've done ministry in one capacity or another for a decade, but because it was outside of the United Methodist Church, it doesn't really count. The two master's levels degrees that I have and the doctor of ministry that I'm seeking, those aren't Methodist, so that could bring me trouble as well in terms of ordination. So for a church that seems so wide open, there's still quite a few things that aren't quite so wide open. And those things in terms of polity, again, they seem like barriers to entry.
Yeah.
And so very specifically, what's happened is I've been called just this last week to do pastoral ministry as a lead pastor at an American Baptist church here in National City. So it's a multicultural, multilingual church, which fits kind of what I'm interested in. It's pretty urban, which fits what I'm interested in. So it seems like it'll be a really good fit for me. And then two, because their polity is much more congregational, I can move in quickly, and even though, you know, it's an older church, the ministry isn't going to change quickly. I'll be affirmed as someone who is capable of doing ministry from day one, essentially. And that's pretty attractive. Also, it seems like a place that I can just continue to use the gifting that I think God has given me in terms of teaching and in terms of justice ministries and things like that. So that's where I'm headed right now in terms of vocation. I'm doing that. I'm also going to be starting to teach theology and church history courses with a seminary in San Jose, Costa Rica, with their online program. And I'm involved in teaching and tutoring with the local evangelical seminary, Bethel Seminary. So I have a lot of things still going on. And in terms of discernment, I think the Apostolic Academy helped me realize that, yes, I want to be involved in ministry, but I want to be involved in ministry in more traditional senses. So one foot in the church and one foot in academic theology.
Well, my asthma is suggesting that perhaps this interview is over.
All right.
So my apologies for the coughing and interruptions. But I do want to close with prayer and by thanking you both very, very much. I really, really appreciate your participation. And the fact that you brought to, the cohort, the level of experience that each of you had, I think really made a tremendous difference. I think I know the other folks in our group really looked up to the two of you, and I appreciated that each of you stood in and taught on occasion when I was not able to be there, or when there were parts of the curriculum that you all were capable of teaching. And so, for all those reasons, I'm very grateful to both of you. And I do think the group as a whole, we dwindled over time. That's another change that I think I'll make, is I need to figure out a way that I think the experience for some of our colleagues was that if their life circumstances prevented them from launching a project, they felt like, well, then now I need to withdraw from the program. You know what I mean? So I think I need to figure out a way if I were to do it again, I would want to make sure that there was some way that while still encouraging the initiating of a pilot project, to not have that be the sole track, you know what I mean? Or the sole, the presumed outcome for everybody.
Right.
And I would want to figure out a way for people to feel like they could still be a part of the experience even if they themselves weren't going to pilot a project. A couple of people hung in that capacity. But for many, I know it felt that, well, I'm not going to do a project, so therefore why would I continue? That's another takeaway for me. But I'm very grateful. So thank you so much.
Well, and thank you, John.
Yeah.
It's good to see that your initiative and entrepreneurial spirit is shining some light here at First Church and beyond.
Yeah, and then I will, if you're willing, I'll share this with some friends. I've never been involved in our United Methodist Boards of Ordained Ministry. And I had a fascinating experience. I went to Southern Illinois last week for a conference. Met a woman who's the district superintendent. She was saying they have 900 churches in their annual conference, and half of them have fewer than 30 members.
Wow.
Small rural churches. And she said, our conference is always starved for pastors, right? Mostly they need pastors who will do multi-point charges and pastor these small...
Circuit rider pastors.
And we're the exact opposite here in Southern California, where our churches, we have probably too many pastors, or at least too many elders. And our churches are, we have a pipeline that's built to produce ordained elders, and there aren't that many positions for ordained elders anymore. You know what I mean? So I am interested in the idea of some kind of leadership academy that would meet the real needs of the world and the real needs of the church of today in Southern California. as opposed to the needs of the world and the needs of the church circa 1890,
right.
Which is kind of when the United Methodist Church went all in on its model of ordained ministry, I hate to say.
Old school.
Old school, indeed. Yeah, that quite, when you're, yeah, when you're, I would argue we're at least a century behind, maybe working on our second century behind the curve. So thank you so much for this time, and can I offer a closing prayer?
Yes, please.
That'd be great.
God, thank you for this day. Thank you for Julie. Thank you for Seth. Thank you for their willingness to invest in the time and heart and soul in this endeavor. God, you alone know what will come of it. The projects that they led, the academy experience that we shared, the work that you're doing in each of our lives. So we give you all honor and praise this day, for we know that you are good and your mercy is forever. And I thank you for having called these your servants, Seth and Julie, into your ministry. And I ask your blessing on them, and I ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you.